From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Emily Tompkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. President Joe Biden enjoying favorable public opinion for a giant economic stimulus plan passed by Congress also has to contend with a surge of migrants from Central and South America arriving without visas. And thousands of children not accompanied by their parents are being held by the U.S. government. President Biden is sharply critical of Russia's President Vladimir Putin just after U.S. intelligence agencies accused Putin of ordering interference in American politics this past year. Allegedly, Russia was trying to help Donald Trump. Government authorities here say a major danger to security in the U.S. is posed by right-wing extremists, many of them racists, willing to use violence. And we'll talk about the civil war in Syria 10 years after it began. The war has killed hundreds of thousands of people while changing the Middle East and also security and immigration policies in many countries. Let's begin with you, Linda Feldman. President Biden failed to get even one Republican in Congress to vote for the $1.9 trillion in economic stimulus and measures to fight the COVID pandemic. But still, he's playing that issue as a victory. The plan and the money transfers to most Americans do seem popular, Linda.
The plan is very popular. The Pew Research Center finds that 70%, 70, of the American public likes the plan. And that has to include a lot of Trump voters. So this is a package of measures that transcends political polarization. And honestly, you can point right to Donald Trump for that, because he was not a fiscal conservative. He was a Republican president, but he really flouted the norm of conservatism about the spending of public money. So he, for example, supported sending $2,000 to each American, even though when he was president, it only came to $600 in that last package. Individuals who make less than $75,000 a year will get $1,400. There's just money going all over the place to state and local governments, expanded health coverage under Obamacare, funding for education, et cetera, et cetera. If you're an American who's struggling mightily under the pandemic, you can't pay your rent, you can't feed your children, this is a godsend, and it's a really tough one to oppose, even though, as you said, no Republicans voted for it.
Well, they say that there's too much waste in this aid program, that there are favors to labor unions. And they insist also that President Biden is failing to unite the nation, which he claimed would be perhaps the hallmark of his presidency. Emily, what do you make of that?
You know, I think on this one, I think this is the sort of thing, these calls for, oh, Biden didn't unite the nation, and these calls for bipartisanship above getting policy through. It's so interesting because Republicans often speak about things that real Americans care about as opposed to people in the Beltway. I think this is the kind of thing where Americans outside the Beltway care about getting this money and care about getting this relief and care about getting through the pandemic and back to work. I'm sure that there is a set of people who will focus on the fact that no Republicans voted for it and think that that reflects poorly on Biden and the Democrats. But one wonders if there aren't many more who will think of this as Republicans not coming to the table to support a policy that directly helps Americans.
Either way, it doesn't seem like there's more unity in America. Still divisions about just about everything. For instance, a problem on the border with Mexico after the number of illegal migrants entering the U.S. fell during Donald Trump's 4 years as president. He was very hostile toward them, and he immediately deported people. But now there are migrants who apparently believe that the Biden administration will be much more open. And thousands of people from, well, as far away as Bolivia, many more from Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico, they make a dangerous journey. They somehow cross into the United States. They then turn themselves in to U.S. Border Patrol officers, believing they won't be forced to leave. Linda, you cover the White House. I know there were many questions about the detention by the United States of thousands of children not accompanied by their parents.
Right. And actually, the system that has been set up incentivizes that behavior. So under a pandemic health order that was out during Donald Trump's presidency, most adults and families are being summarily turned away. They're being sent back. But the Biden administration has allowed unaccompanied children under the age of 18 to enter the U.S. while their claims are processed. So these unaccompanied children arrive and they immediately look for a phone number on a piece of paper in the child's pocket, for example. That might be the name of a family friend or a relative. And these children a lot of them are in detention facilities on the border, and it's a crisis situation. But a lot of these children do have connections in the United States, and they're being placed with those connections. So this is a trick for families in Central America and in even South America to send their children north and get them into the United States. It's just a toehold into the country, and they're using it.
Emily, you write about American affairs for a British magazine. I'm wondering how you're describing this, because, you know, Republicans say it's a crisis on the border, and the White House is adamantly saying it's a problem, but they want to avoid the word crisis. This isn't just about words, though.
No, it isn't. And I think two things. I think that this is one of the stories that is between the pandemic and the politics of Washington and foreign policy, although this is a foreign policy issue, that this is getting lost in our perception of what's happening in the United States right now, which is a shame because, as you say, it is a hugely significant story that's not just about words. And the second thing is that I think that we do need to look at the ways in which it is taking time to unroll and unwind Trump policies. I will also say that when the White House press secretary Jen Psaki says, well, we're having a lot of criticism on how migrant children are being treated, but none of our critics are coming with a plan. And to me, it's sort of like, well, you're the administration now, right? So it's your turn to present a plan, to present a policy, and to implement that policy for how to treat migrants, and particularly migrant children, with dignity.
An issue that came up in recent days is the United States publicly accusing Russia and Iran of meddling in the American election last year. An official report from the intelligence agencies, the Director of National Intelligence here in Washington, claimed Russia's President Vladimir Putin was trying to help Donald Trump get reelected, largely by planting false stories in the American media, including claims that the Biden family was involved in illegal activities in Ukraine. And then President Biden called Putin a killer who had no human soul. Biden added that Russia will pay a heavy price for interfering in U.S. politics. Emily, contrast that with then-President Trump never having wanted to accuse Russia.
Rhetorically, the difference is, I mean, it could not be more stark, right? You have Trump, who, as you said, never said anything bad about Putin, versus Biden literally calling him a soulless killer. But where it gets more complicated is, how does that rhetoric translate into policy? And the reality is that what we have seen for many administrations now is that though the United States can, as Biden pledged, do put in place actions to try to make Putin pay, to try to make Russia pay, they have not, I mean, after so many sanctions, after this harsh speech, after that person's banned from going to the U.S., have not really been able to get a change in behavior. And so to me, the more interesting question is, rather than like who says what about whom next, is can the Biden administration find a way to change Russian behavior? Or are we just going to, you know, have increasingly frosty relations in this war of words?
Well, the administration that took over here on January 20th, the Biden administration, says it's going to work more closely with the NATO alliance to challenge Russian behavior. And that report from the U.S. Director of National Intelligence also says that China considered meddling in the U.S. election last year, but decided not to. Now, on this whole story, Linda, what do you think of the Biden administration deciding to go public?
They're trying to draw a sharp contrast with Donald Trump. As Emily said, Donald Trump principally never criticized Vladimir Putin. It was pretty transparent that he just had no interest in going there. Who knows what he was thinking, but it was a strange situation because the administration itself and Republican members of Congress were willing to criticize Putin and, for example, put on new sanctions against government officials. But Trump himself just never went there. So now it's a new day. We have a new administration, the other party. We have the situation now with the Russian ambassador, Anatoly Antonov, who's been recalled to Moscow for, quote, consultations. I see this, frankly, as performative. They just need to show that they're not going to take this lying down. But honestly, the Russians understand that they need to keep talking to the United States. I mean, it's important that the U.S. and Russia just extended the New START arms control treaty by 5 years. That's in place. That was, frankly, the most important issue on the U.S.-Russian agenda. Now the U.S. is turning to its dealings in Asia and with China, most importantly, with Secretary of State Antony Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan meeting in Alaska with China's top two diplomats.
That might have achieved some breakthroughs, but the early indications from the American side, with, as you say, the Secretary of State and the Defense Secretary taking part, there's a reconsideration of U.S. policy toward Asia in general after those two senior U.S. officials also had talks in Japan and South Korea. We'll have to see what the outcome will be. Let's bring the focus here to the United States and a disgusting crime. A 21-year-old was arrested near Atlanta, Georgia, as police and prosecutors say that he was the man who entered three massage parlors with a rifle and murdered eight people, six of them Asian American women. While police reported the man was claiming he did not have racist motives, supposedly not aiming to kill people of Chinese and Korean backgrounds. Emily, you wrote in the New Statesman that this mass murder came against the background of a sickening increase in violence against Asian Americans, partly, maybe mostly, because some people in the U.S. think they can abuse and blame, they think, people from China for the COVID coronavirus. This is a growing issue, Emily.
There are three things that I want to say about this. The first is that the fact that a suspect says that something was not a racist act does not make it not a racist act. The person who committed a racist offense is not the authority on whether or not that thing is racist. Second of all, I think it's very important that we note that in the United States, we cannot disentangle anti-Asian racism and misogyny. The 1875 Page Act banned women who were going to immigrate to the United States, ostensibly, according to authorities, to engage in prostitution. This was in effect used to keep out East Asian and particularly Chinese women, the implication being that these women were prostitutes. So there is a long history of both racist but also misogynistic discrimination against Asians and particularly Asian women in this country. And the third thing, and the thing that I kept coming back to in the past couple of days as this was playing out, is that Asian Americans and Asians in America have been telling us for a year now that they feel unsafe. Hate crimes against Asians in America increased by 150% from 2019 to 2020. There were roughly 3,800 hate crimes against Asians in America reported last year. The first spike coincides with the use of terms like China virus and Wuhan virus, and you had people keep using these terms even after Asian Americans said repeatedly, we are being attacked. We feel unsafe because you are using this rhetoric. And so I think that one of the things we need to take forward is that those of us who speak about politics and geopolitics and great power competition and the fallout from the pandemic need to be very careful and considerate in the way in which we speak about these issues, because these words do, you know, we were speaking earlier about the difference between words and actions, but words can affect actions. And that's what you're seeing here. Now, that's not to excuse any of the hate crimes for the past year, right? Nobody but the people who carried them out and made them do it. But after enough stories of elderly Asian men, you know, being attacked and dying and people being spit on and people being like, at some point something has to give. And I think that thing has to be our behavior.
Speaking of violence here in the United States, we saw another public report from the Office of the Director for National Intelligence about American radicals who are expected to carry out lethal attacks, most likely this year, in the United States. Commenting at a congressional hearing, the Secretary for Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, said DVE, domestic violent extremism, is one of the gravest and most persistent threats that we as a country face. The intelligence report says the most dangerous are racist groups, some of whom form so-called militias, claiming they are the real patriots. Linda, a lot of people here are linking this assessment with what happened on January 6th, when extremists, many waving Trump flags, invaded the U.S. Capitol building, an incident blamed for at least five deaths.
Right, exactly. You know, a lot of people are linking this to Donald Trump for obvious reasons. I mean, I'm recalling Donald Trump in his debate with Joe Biden last September when he was asked about the Proud Boys, a well-known white supremacist group. He didn't denounce them. He said to stand back and stand by. He was essentially, in his own way, encouraging them. But I have to point out, militias and white supremacist terrorism in this country far precedes Donald Trump. I mean, we remember at the beginning of Bill Clinton's presidency, the attack on the Murrah building, the big federal office building in Oklahoma City. This is a long festering problem in this country, which really was brought to the fore during the Trump years and remains a terrible problem with the continuing disinformation that's out there that encourages these groups and encourages people to do terrible things. So this is, as the Director of National Intelligence correctly pointed out, it's just a huge problem, both white supremacists and militias, and everybody's on the lookout, but it's just, in some ways, it's just impossible to defend against. You know, individual liberty, freedom of movement, freedom of speech are embedded in our Constitution in a very profound way. And I think, you know, Americans just have to be on guard. And I'm reading, for example, in Massachusetts that legislators are now stocking up on bulletproof vests and pepper spray and other defensive mechanisms. I mean, it's just a sad turn of events in this country that even state legislators are feeling under threat.
And another feature that makes the United States different from most countries is the constitutional protection for the right to own weapons, to own guns. We have a lot more to talk about, notably the 10th anniversary of the civil war in Syria and the COVID pandemic, the hope that vaccines will end it when we come back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Emily Tompkin, U.S. Editor for The New Statesman, and our moderator, Dan Rabib, columnist for Newsday.
The coronavirus pandemic has been the major tragedy and disruption all around planet Earth now for just over one full year. The number of deaths all around the world, more than 2,700,000. Here in the United States, more than 540,000 people have died, more than in any other country. The second worst afflicted is Brazil, where health authorities say COVID is getting worse. Over 285,000 deaths in Brazil. President Biden has predicted that life in the United States may be back to normal more or less in about 1 year from now. He's urging everyone to be vaccinated. And even former President Trump finally urged his followers to say yes to the vaccines. Linda, you've covered the frequent briefings by Biden administration health officials. How should we judge the distribution of the three different vaccines being used in the U.S.?
So in this country, things seem to get off to a slow start, but it's rapidly accelerated. Now lots of people have had one, if not both, of their vaccines. It's actually looking pretty good here. And Joe Biden did, of course, make that public statement on the anniversary of the shutdown, suggesting that we could actually have gatherings on July 4th, American Independence Day. There are frustrations. America is a highly decentralized country. Each state decides how to handle the distribution of vaccines. But at the same time, if you look at, say, what's happening in Europe, which seems to be just a complete disaster, or Brazil, another disaster in the works, I think we're feeling pretty grateful in this country. I mean, I'm shocked, for example, in Europe, that they've suspended the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine because of reports about blood clots. You know, I think they need to really examine that and make sure that's really true. I mean, Europe is, you know, a high-income part of the world, and I just can't fathom how they don't have their act together, frankly.
Emily, several opinion polls here in the U.S. indicate a large majority of Americans think President Biden's doing a good job fighting coronavirus. It seems around 70% are willing to get the vaccine shot. spots. But many Americans are anxious to get back to work and have fun. For instance, spring break on the beaches of Florida seemed crowded with people not being very careful with masks and distancing. And about one-third of the 50 states in the U.S. are dropping just about all restrictions. They're proudly reopening. These contrasts, again, in what Linda's described as not a very consistent or united United States. Emily?
You know when you see somebody running a race and right as they get to the end, they slow down and then somebody else overtakes them and wins? That's kind of what I feel like we're watching right now in some states, and with some people even in states where everybody is still wearing masks, because we're so close. It's been a year. We're all so tired of this, but we're almost there. And so to see governors now, when we're so close, remove mask mandates before people are vaccinated, we're fully vaccinated, or some people are vaccinated and some aren't, just seems so self-defeating. And, you know, we know more now than we did this time last year, right? So we know that a person on a beach, even without a mask, is definitely going to be safer than somebody inside in Miami not wearing a mask. But that said, we also know the best practices are social distance and with masks on. And so I think, you know, until we're out of this, we should all continue to do that. Otherwise, we are going to lose this race.
Let's close this program by discussing the civil war in Syria. The war is not over, although it appears pretty clear that President Bashar al-Assad is remaining in office. It began in 2011 when anti-government demonstrators were violently suppressed by the Assad regime, and that government has kept bombing its own cities when they were held by rebels. Along the way, the Islamic radical fighters called ISIS or Daesh took over parts of Syria. The U.S. military had a major role in pushing back ISIS. A lot of foreign forces got involved. Russia and Iran have propped up President Assad's government. Turkey entered Syria to suppress Kurdish forces. Israel fairly frequently bombs Iranian troops and supplies in Syria. And amid all this, more than 400,000 people have been killed, and about half of Syria's population had to flee their homes. More than 6 million are refugees in neighboring countries, and others have moved to Europe. Linda, is Syria still a high priority for the United States under Joe Biden?
In a word, no. Joe Biden obviously has a lot on his plate, though he's reportedly close to releasing humanitarian funding for Syria. So that's something. As you say, the situation there for people is horrific. There are no signs that Syria will be anywhere near the top of Joe Biden's Middle East agenda, or that he will become involved militarily beyond taking retaliatory measures in the country. I mean, one example is that he has not appointed a special envoy to Syria, although he has assigned special envoys to Yemen and Iran. So this is just a sign that he just doesn't see Syria as something worth putting a huge amount of energy into.
Counterterrorism officials here in Washington say we have to watch Syria because when a country is so unstable, it could become a place for ISIS and terrorist groups to reorganize and aim against the U.S. and its allies. Emily, if we look at it on a global scale, you know, there are a lot of conflicts all around the world, violent situations in Africa, in Asia after the military coup in Myanmar, also known as Burma. The army has been killing anti-regime protesters. But Syria is one of the worst situations since World War II. I'm not sure that the U.S. can really ignore what's going on there, Emily.
It's not so much that the U.S. is ignoring what's going on there, I think, as it is, as Linda said, it's just fallen off the table of main things that we're concerned about. And I feel like I don't have a good answer to this question because it's gone on for a decade now. And on the one hand, we know the scale of the devastation. But on the other, I think it's going to take a long time to wrap our heads around the devastation that unfolded in that country and that is still unfolding. You know, we'll be concerned for counterterrorism reasons or for Russia, Iran reasons. But I think the humanitarian reasons, it's fallen out of the headlines. It's fallen out of the headlines. It's fallen out of the questions that are posed to these leaders when we go and do these press conferences with them. And I understand that. It's because it's gone on for so long and there's no resolution and it's hard for people to keep interest in that kind of story for that long. But on the other hand, it's still the central story to the people who lived it and who suffered there and who are still suffering because of it.
And really a lot of impact all over the Middle East and other countries, but no solutions. That's all the time we have for this edition of Issues in the News. Thanks to our panelists, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravitch.